We are chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's C-A-T-C-H. I call it the Catch Cast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our geeky subjects as myself and the guests. In this edition, we want to know about the future of the railways. Are they getting the investment they need? Will taking them into public ownership help improve the service? Today, we're honoured to be joined by one of Britain's leading writers and broadcasters on the rail industry, Christian Woolmar. Welcome to the Catchcast, Christian.
Well, I'm very pleased to be with you.
I think you published something like, is it 20 books now on railway history? And we see you a lot in the news commentating on transport issues. But I wonder if I can maybe take you back a bit and ask how you got interested in trains in the first place.
Well, I have a dirty little secret that when I was 10, 11, 12, I would hang about at the end of platforms and actually what was called bunking sheds. In other words, kind of, you could just walk into train sheds and just take all the numbers, and the drivers would just smile at you and sometimes let you onto the footplate. I mean, it was just a different world. And that was Old Oak Common, and Wilsdon was opposite. And it was great fun being a train spotter. But, you know, by the age of 15, I got interested in other things, notably girls, and sort of gave that up. And then kind of 30 odd years later, I got made transport correspondent at The Independent in 1992. And as you know, this was a very interesting time with the privatisation of the railways. And I got a lot of copy into the paper, a lot of front page pieces and stuff. And it went on from there.
And then you went on to write for many other publications and made loads of telly appearances too. When did you make your first book, Christian?
Well, I didn't write my first book till I was nearly 50, actually. So this is encouragement for older listeners, which was Stagecoach, which was nothing to do with stagecoaches have been held up and whatever, highwaymen. But it was actually a history of the bus company. And that was actually sort of my first book. I had done some little ones before then. And then that took me on to doing a history of the London Underground, the Subterranean Railway, Fire and Steam, which still been reprinted because that was a history of Britain's railways. It's been reprinted as for the 200th anniversary of Stockton Darlington. And then a whole host of other books on the Trans-Siberian Railway, on Indian railways, American railways, British Rail, Crossrail, and so on. So it's been fantastic fun. And I've really produced about a book a year for the last 20 years.
Well, that is very impressive. I think it was Subterranean Railway, which was the first of yours that I read and became aware of. And then, of course, Fire and Steam, as you say. So if you're doing one a year, how long does the research take for each new title?
Well, this is it's another dirty little secret, really, Mark. I kind of, if I've been commissioned to write a book, and of course, I write all my books only when I've been commissioned and get something in advance, I sort of spend a couple of months wasting time, really, and sort of reading a little bit about it, sketching out a synopsis and whatever. But then I start writing, and then I realise I don't know enough about certain things, and so I then kind of look it up, and then I'm researching as I'm going along. And so it's a dual process. I found that if I do a lot of research in advance and try and type up notes, it just wastes the time. It doesn't work for me at all. Mm-hmm. I am, you know, kind of through and through a daily newspaper journalist. And so just doing the research simultaneously with the writing is what works for me. So it takes about, you know, 9 months, but not kind of full time because I still do a lot of other things. But about 9 months to write a book. I mean, the last one I wrote, The Liberation Line, took rather longer, but we can go into that later. But that was because there was really a lot of primary research. But most of all, I cheat, right? I cheat because I get lots of other people's books on the subject or lots of kind of research papers or whatever. And my skill is not that I'm the world's best researcher or that I know more than anything. My skill is that I write quite well. And so I just write up their stories better than they have told them. So as I'm sure you have, I mean, I've got, and I'm looking at it now, kind of, I've got about 1,000 books in my railway collection.
Wow.
And a lot of those are really poorly written, but with lots of invaluable information. And so I nick that information and basically recycle it. So, you know, that's my skill. It's kind of doing a précis of other people's work.
Recycle and regurgitate with style.
Absolutely, yes.
And I love what you said just now about you understand a certain fact to be the word on the subject. And then when you look into it and you research, you think, hang on, maybe it wasn't quite as straightforward as that. And that sends you on into other rabbit holes and you find new things that perhaps haven't been found before.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And also you kind of end up discovering little highways and byways that nobody has really gone down. And I'll give a nice example of that. I mean, for my book, The Liberation Line, which I'm incredibly invested in because I think it's an amazing story, the story of the railways that were rebuilt after D-Day. And it was literally the last week or two that I was doing any kind of writing about it. And I was in the last but one chapter or something. And suddenly I discovered that there'd been this terrible train crash in early 1945 on the Normandy coast. Saint-Vallier-en-Court, it was called. And it had killed 89 US servicemen, mostly of a tank regiment. And it had been a runaway train. The train had been overloaded. And nobody had ever written about this. And it was so secret that basically some of the servicemen who were injured it couldn't get treatment in veterans hospitals because they didn't believe what had happened to them. And so you do kind of come across little gems that just by kind of plugging away and kind of following little items here and there. And that's one of the real thrills of it, actually, is that, you know, you might be kind of looking at, you know, secondary work, but people have tucked away these little stories that you then can uncover. And basically, I'm telling stories, Mark. And as you know, you write books as well. I mean, I tell stories, and that's what book writing is all about.
That is a very fine insight into your latest book, Liberation Line. Now, in one of your earlier books, Blood, Iron and Gold, you basically argue that railways changed the whole history of the world. Can you give us a sort of brief idea of why you thought that?
Oh, Mark, you know, that's a full toss. I'm going to swat away with joy. Look, there is no other comparable invention that was so transformational. I mean, it was transformational in so many ways. First of all, you know, the Industrial Revolution was happening in northeastern corner of the UK, and it was the railways that were, well, the Industrial Revolution enabled the railways, the trains, steam engines to be created, but then the railways spread that technology around Britain and around the world. So it was a kind of double whammy, as it were, because the Industrial Revolution created these amazing new engines and this amazing new technology, and they created the railways, which then spread the technology. So it was a kind of symbiotic process. But then there's so many other aspects as well. I mean, railways changed the way people ate by enabling food to be transported for far longer distance, fresh milk or fresh fish. It changed the banking system because the railways created the biggest companies. These early train companies were by far bigger than anything else. They changed employment practices because, you know, you had to manage staff in kind of, you know, across whole countries, which, you know, no other business had, apart from the military, had ever done before. It helped create mass sports games by transporting both the teams and the supporters around the country. So when you kind of start looking at various aspects of the way we live, the railways enabled it all. It was the engine of capitalism, you know, that it was the catalyst for spreading capitalism around the world with the associated technology. So I just defy anybody to counter that with any other example. Of course, people now say, well, the car changed everything. Yeah, but the car came kind of 70, 80 years later and was an added-on technology that was using, as it were, the kind of paths that had been opened up by the railways and the transport routes that had been opened up the railways. But it was the railways that triggered off the whole modern world, really.
And you were talking about, as you're writing books, little gems come up. I remember when I was doing Railway Maps of the World, I got this satellite view at night time of where all the cities are in the centre of continents. And if you overlay that with where the railways are, you can see basically, in most cases, that it was the development of the railways that allowed us to penetrate the inside of the continents. That's where all the settlements are.
Well, yes, the Blood, Iron and Gold book focuses a lot on the transcontinental railways in different parts of the world. I mean, notably, of course, America was the most famous, which ended up with kind of five or six kind of transcontinental railways between the USA and Canada. But also the Trans-Siberian, which kind of crossed a whole, well, two continents, really, Europe and Asia, and was completely, again, transformational in its effect. So, yes, I mean, it's just forgotten about now, isn't it, that the railways played such an important role. And I think if I had to sum up my, dare say the word oeuvre, but slightly pompously, but if I summed up kind of my bibliography, as it were, I would say that argument I'm setting forward in all these books is how transformational they were. And that goes, you know, for the London Underground book, which, you know, helped transform London, right to Blood, Iron and Gold, which shows how the continents were transformed. I mean, it's the micro and the macro.
And it's Railway 200 this year. What's that all about?
Well, that celebrates the opening of the Stockton and Darlington Railway in 1825. Now, okay, and here's another dirty little secret. I think that was a bit of a rubbish railway, really, and I don't think it pioneered anything. It was bringing together the existing technologies. It was a single line railway between two towns that, you know, can't even boast a team in the Division Two, let alone Premiership. And was largely an extension of the old wagon ways, which was taking coal to water and transporting it. It did a few other things, but it was ambitious in its time, and it did carry some passengers, and it did have a few steam engines, although a lot of it was still carried by horse.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Perhaps we've jumped the gun a little bit then with this celebration.
The Liverpool and Manchester in 5 years' time will be celebrating its 200th anniversary. And that is by far more a significant railway because it goes between two major cities who have lots of Premiership teams. It operated in both directions because it actually, you know, carried the raw material to Manchester, and then it would carry the cotton goods back to Liverpool. It was steam run all the way through, even though there were static engines at the Liverpool end, but it was steam run, it was double tracked all the way through. So Liverpool and Manchester, wait for another 5 years and we'll really celebrate that. But look, the Stockton Darlington was a bit of a landmark, but it you know, and it's good that we celebrate that because we can, you know, I think any celebrations around the railway, great idea. But it's the Liverpool and Manchester that, you know, I will really be celebrating.
Well, we can do it all again in 5 years' time.
Yes.
So 200 years have passed and you've written about so many progressive achievements of the railways. Are they still going to be relevant for the next 200 years?
Now, actually, this is fascinating because the railways definitely had a wobble. Of course, they dominated the transport scene for the first, say, 100 years, from, let's say, 1830 to 1920s. You know, there was very few other ways of getting around. You know, aviation hadn't happened. Cars were pretty kind of restricted in how far they could go. The roads were pretty lousy and so on. And then we get, after the Second World War, the big development of highways, motorways, dual carriageways, cars being cheap enough for ordinary people to buy, and aviation pinching a kind of longer rail market. So there was a kind of squeeze at both ends of the rail market. Trucks were taking a lot of the freight and so on. You think, oh, you know, railways, 19th century technology, does it really have a role? And what's amazing has really been the revival of railways.
Indeed, a kind of rail renaissance even.
Yeah.
How's the industry achieved that then in the face of such competition from the likes of planes and cars?
Really by focusing on certain markets where they have a huge advantage. Now, of course, of the First of those was high-speed rail, right, where, you know, instead of kind of trundling at 80, 90 miles an hour between towns and cities, you went nearly twice that speed and you went on dedicated tracks, the Japanese being the first in 1964. So they created motorways of the railways, right? So, and that was absolutely transformational and has now been imitated in no fewer than about 25 countries have dedicated high-speed lines, normally running at about 250 to 300 kilometres per hour. So amazing stuff. So that's a market where they've taken back from the aviation sector. And then there's another market in which railways are absolutely invaluable, and that's suburban and urban trains, and where the idea that, which was prevalent until really the mid-60s in the UK, that actually we don't need trains to take people into towns and cities. Cars can do the whole job. And so we're going to widen all these roads into towns. We're going to kind of create dual carriageways. We're going to create kind of urban motorways. We're going to have huge parking lots in the middle of town. Now, of course, America has done this, and that's how Americans live to this day. But fortunately, in Europe and indeed in many cities in Asia now, they realise that that model just doesn't work, that cars just get too congested and so on. So suburban trains, whether it's trams or whether it's underground or whether it's on the surface trains, are great. And then there's the kind of other aspect. Obviously, heavy freight railways kind of have a huge advantage. And, you know, there's some amazing railways running from mines to, again, to ports across the world. But also, I think there's something that is a bit of a surprise, maybe. It's just railways are so nice to travel along. So lots of kind of regional, sub-regional railways have survived just because it's a much nicer way to travel. It's the only way for people to travel who don't have cars. You know, buses, coaches are okay, but they're nothing like as comfortable as railways. So railways have all these markets in which they have not only survived but flourished. And of course there's other arguments in their support. They're a very sustainable form of transport, as well as being a very pleasant form of transport. They stimulate local economies massively. You know, you only have to look at places where railways have survived, where they do a lot. I compare Chester with Louth here. Louth is an absolutely fantastic city or town. I mean, it has a very big church, but it's not a cathedral, in Lincolnshire, with lots of Georgian terraces and a market town. Absolutely beautiful. And nobody goes there because it doesn't have a railway connection. Whereas Chester is kind of, you know, a similar town which has absolutely massive tourism because it has a railway, and people, Americans, can come along and see it by train and all sorts of things. So that's why railways are important. That's why their survival has been important. And the important thing is that they play a very vital role in transport policy in the 21st century, and they will continue doing so. They're here to stay. Whereas they had this blip post-war where, you know, they could have been wiped out, and they weren't.
Now, you mentioned high speed then. You were famously not such a big supporter originally of HS2, were you? But then again, on your podcast recently, you've said that we've gone so far that we might as well just finish it. But as, of course, as you predicted, it's just been announced it's going to take longer and cost more money to get us to less destinations. Is there something fundamentally wrong with speed, or was it just the way that project was managed?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm writing a book about high speed rail across the world. I've just been to China, where they built 30,000 miles in under 20 years. I've just been to Japan, where obviously they were the first people to build high speed rail. And, you know, I've traveled extensively in France, and I will do so in Spain as well. So, no, there's absolutely not. But what I was against was not the idea of high-speed rail, but was the project that was envisaged, which was really ill thought out. It was built to a 400 kilometre per hour thing. It had to be the greatest kind of high-speed railway in the world. It fell prey to lots of NIMBY interests, which nobody had the strength to stand up to. It was very badly managed. But I do think it was the wrong project all along. I mean, we didn't need that line in the way that it was conceived. But Now, of course, I think you can't abandon those structures. Now, I've seen that there has been some recent coverage. Nigel Farage, no less, backed by Simon Jenkins, columnist in The Guardian, who said, oh, we might as well just give it up. And I don't think you can. If you've been to visit any of those structures they built, 2 mile viaducts over Colne Valley, 10 mile tunnels underneath the Children's. Now, they never needed that 10 mile tunnel in the first place, but they built it now. So I just don't think that, from terms of UK PLC, it would just be too embarrassing to have spent 30 or 40 billion pounds and get nothing out of it. And you probably won't save that much money because a lot of these contracts have been signed and these contractors are not going to go away empty-handed. So we might as well finish it. Although, I mean, I say that with a heavy heart because I don't think it's going to be a fantastically useful line unless they actually then build parts of it that have been scrapped. So they have to build it through to the north, at least through to Crewe. They have to build it through to Euston because having a line that starts kind of 5 miles outside the centre of London in a very inaccessible part of West London, Old Oak Common, would be truly ridiculous. So, you know, the government is stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I think it ought to proceed with it. And it has, you know, earmarked £7 billion a year, Mark, £7 billion a year for the next 3.5-4 years. It's an awful lot of money, and it could have been spent on all sorts of other transport schemes. That was one of my core arguments, that, you know, there was never much of an environmental case for it. Imagine spending 40 or 50 billion pounds on building tram schemes in every town and city in Britain and great cycle lanes and transforming all these city centres. I mean, wow.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Crikey, I can't believe that we've run right out of time. And just as you're getting into your flow there.
There you go.
We didn't even get to mention your excellent podcast, Calling All Stations. And I'd really love to go into more detail with you about the funding of HS2. I tell you what, can we please have you back on the Catchcast again?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the meantime, I must tell you that Christian's latest book on the role of the railways in the Normandy landings, The Liberation Line, is, as he mentioned, available now. And this has been fascinating. And we will have you back, Christian. Many, many thanks for joining us. And you can find Christian's podcast, Calling All Stations, at the place where you look for other podcasts or just use a search engine. And many of his books are still available with more on the way, like the one about high-speed rail. Hope you've enjoyed listening as much as I have. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We are going to the factory where the enamel signs are made for the railways right across Britain and Europe.